The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
Sorry, I'm going to do a belch.
Do you need some?
Maybe you need
me to be burped.
Get my reflux.
Shoulders.
Well done.
Calitato, this is Gone by Lunchtime. It's January 25, 2024, a whole new year, back here in the studio for Gone by Lunchtime. I'm Toby Manhire, kia ora Ben Thomas.
Kia ora.
Annabelle Lee Mather, kia ora.
Kia ora.
Nice to see you both. Also nice to see Jay Butler.
Tēnā koe, Toby. Today.
Happy New Year, belatedly, tum to tum. Going to get into things very shortly. First, some administration. Some admin. We are doing a live podcast, which hopefully everyone is alert to, on February the 15th, Thursday the February 15th, as part of a Podfest at Q. That's Q Theatre in centre of Auckland.
Did you forget to get your partner a Valentine's Day gift?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
It's the day after.
Perfect. Wow, yeah.
The perfect
thoughtful
makeup.
Yes.
Thing is to come and see our podcast.
To Gone
Super
by
romantic.
Lunchtime. Yeah.
Oh, no, baby, I did get you. I got you tickets to the special Gone by Lunchtime show tomorrow.
Is that the thing you listen to when you're wandering around the kitchen?
I'd be thrilled.
Get this as well. You can get tickets at Q Theatre. I realise that we will be, this is quite terrifying, potentially. We'll be on that live podcast, we'll be celebrating our 8th birthday. 8 years of Gone by Lunchtime. Quite a long time.
Wow, it
still
is.
Still as fresh and entertaining and novel as ever.
I mean, we 8 years ago invented podcasting. It was the was the first podcast. Not many people know that.
Yeah.
More admin. We ran recently a crowdfunding campaign for a series that is going to be running on the Spinoff in the year to come called What's Eating Aotearoa. One of the reward levels was if you contributed a certain amount, you got a shout out on Gone by Lunchtime podcast, which is cool. And a handful of people paid their money for that particular privilege. They were offered the opportunity of either being praised or denounced.
Mm.
Everyone chose praise, which is good, which is fine.
Yeah. Was there a higher tier whereby you would be praised, but people wouldn't know it was because you gave Toby money?
Oh. No, that's your business, Ben. That's not how we do it here. So, Carol Green. Shout out to Carol Green. Thank you, Carol Green. I've got Claire written here. They're just Claire. There are lots of great Claires around.
I don't think you didn't
Claire's
praise,
are good.
You didn't praise Carol.
Oh, I love Carol Green. You're amazing.
Yeah.
Claire.
Number one, Carol.
Just Claire alone. I don't know. It could be. There's so many good Claires around, aren't there?
Not as good as that
Claires.
One.
But not as not good as,
not
good
as, good as this particular Claire.
She's the cream de la cream of
the clearest of all the Claires. Mm. Felicity Letcher, the exquisite Felicity Letcher. Thank you, Felicity. Ange Wadsworth. Ange Wadsworth. I would
love
like to
her.
Praise Ange. Yeah,
she's amazing. Going honestly, on about every her. Time we catch
sometimes
up.
Sometimes too much. And Courtney Johnston.
Oh, is that
friend
that's
of
our
the
friend
pod?
Courtney.
Friend of the pod.
Yeah.
Fantastic, Courtney Johnson. Praise her even if she didn't. Well, we'll praise all of these people. It's not about the money. It's never about the money.
No, from now on, if she stops.
It's about the money.
If the tap turns off, that's it for Courtney.
That's right.
It's just harsh, unrelenting criticism.
And Marie Elliott Jones and her high-quality children, Edie and Morris.
Aww. So
top-notch children.
Peabody.
Terrific, Marie. Terrific children. Finally, I'm not a contributor, but over the holidays, my friend Kerri-Ann texted me that she was on holiday with another family and the 11-year-old Freddie was a very keen fan of Gone by Lunchtime. Listen to every episode. So I just wanted to shout out Freddie.
Shout out Freddie.
The future of Aotearoa is secure.
Send Kerri-Ann an invoice.
Freddie.
Yeah. Ben won't let you vote, but...
And last thing before we get into it, we just want to acknowledge the passing of Selwyn Mudu, a fantastic contributor to New Zealand culture. Kia ora, Selwyn. All right. Let's talk about the three-headed Taniwha. We've had an extra sort of event. There's always Ratana and Waitangi are the sort of kind of, you know, part of the
quote-unquote the Māori political calendar
of the political year. The political year as a whole, it's got, you know, it's sort of, you sort of know things gear up. In politics generally, in Māori politics specifically.
Traditionally in New Zealand, we have the situation where real politics starts after Parliament sits, and you have the kind of warm-ups. We just do Māori politics to begin with. It's kind of like a pre-season game for the league. Still a bit of fun. You just have a bit of a run around.
We're only sort of four minutes in, and Ben's already canceled himself.
Just gotta loosen up. No, I'm making a stinging criticism of the way that we've previously regarded Māori issues.
Probably until
the last sort of, I would say, decade and a half in New Zealand politics, where it's almost been sort of partitioned off at the beginning. So you go to Ratana, you go to Waitangi, and then you're like, done and dusted. Now let's get on to arguing about ministerial car expenses and all the important stuff.
Okay, I'm glad we clarified the heavy dollop of irony involved there.
Beautiful.
This year, Annabelle,
yes,
we had a third kind of installed when Kingitanga hosted Hui Amotu. 10 and 12,000 people reported to have been there the weekend before last, Ngaru Wahia, at Tūranga Waiwai Marae. And it was put together in response to a range of measures that are being introduced in the new coalition government to talk about it. Christopher Luxon said that it wasn't about the government, it was about a range of topics, said Christopher Luxon, who's been also insisting, which I like quite a lot, he's been talking about aeration of issues a lot lately. He likes the aeration of issues, so it's going to be a big year for aeration. That event, Ngaru Wahia, Annabelle, was quite an impressive turnout. People seemed to come away from it. I don't know if you were there. I wasn't there. Were you there?
Yeah.
Can you give us a rundown on the event? Also, maybe like a quick Coles Notes on Kingitanga and where that sits within Te Ao Māori?
So the Kingitanga is a political movement that was, you know, established in response to, you know, the growing tensions between Māori and the Crown and conflict and all of that sort of stuff. And as a result, it's probably one of the most enduring political institutions in Aotearoa. Over the weekend, they hosted a hui to discuss a cohesive response by Māori to the proposed legislation regarding the Acts Treaty Bill and the re-terming of the principles, rephrasing, rewriting, reinterpretation of the treaty.
Minor edits.
Treaty principles. Along with a whole lot of other issues around, you know, what Māori see as the minimisation of te reo Māori by this government, so on and so forth. There was about 10 to 12,000 people, which exceeded even the expectations of the Haukainga. There was all sorts of people from every walk of life, kaumātua, kuia, Māori leaders, gang members, the Greasy Dogs, the Mongrel Mob, social workers, hauora, reporters, everyone you can think of, plenty of Pākehā, predominantly Māori, who engaged in a range of discussions. There was a number of breakout panels around oranga, well-being, what that means for the environment, economically, health-wise. There was a panel on the treaty, a panel on the reo, where basically 10,000 people listened to and engaged in a discussion about those issues. It was a remarkable hui, not just because of how uplifting and positive and unifying it felt to be there, but also because it was a really powerful reminder of what a remarkable institution the kingitanga is and the foresight of our tūpuna to set it up, because to be able to host 10,000 people, you know, with 6 weeks' notice to literally feed them, sunscreen them, water them.
Was there shelter? It was very hot.
There was marquees set up everywhere. Amazing. So there was a whole lot of different marquees with different panels happening in them at the same time. Mm. It was hot and everyone was really incredibly well taken care of. And the power of the kingitanga is really that there is this amazing ope workforce, ropu, that sits behind it, people that will come at a drop of a hat to serve that movement, to park people, clear the rubbish, feed people, all in honour of the kingitanga. And then the added, I guess, power that it has nowadays is that, you know, it is centred in Waikato Tainui, who are an iwi that now have a $1 billion economic base to draw on. So, you know, the potential to literally drag the government through every court in the land and potentially overseas as well. But incredible number of issues discussed, everything from gangs to the well-being of our tamariki to all of the stuff that's happening in government, and just a really positive, powerful hui.
Mm. That then was followed by Ratana, was the sort of next set piece, which was yesterday. And that's normally a pretty sort of serene kind of by design event, and there was a bit more politics that seeped into it than usual. And as you mentioned, Annabelle, it's the ACT Party's Treaty Principles Bill that has become the centre of the pushback. There are a range of different issues, but that one has become increasingly the focus. Christopher Luxon is under pressure increasingly and he's in a difficult position, Ben, because he is asked, so you're only supporting this bill to select committee, this bill which would rewrite the principles of the treaty. And to be clear, the principles of the treaty are not the same as the articles of the treaty. The principles of the treaty are... they are a construct that have been created by politicians and courts as a way of trying to interpret and apply the treaty, two treaties, an English language treaty and a Māori language treaty, into legislation. Geoffrey Palmer did that in the late 80s, and through the courts and through the Waitangi Tribunal. So, and they're an ongoing thing. And if you, you know, the Waitangi Tribunal say this is an evolving set of principles. But the set of principles proposed in the bill, which would be put to a referendum if passed, have no mention of anything like rangatiratanga or kawanatanga or partnership or anything like that. They're basically, we're all the same guys. That's kind of the summary of it. So my question to you, though, is how is Luxon managing that in terms of, he basically is saying, this is not National Party policy. We don't want to do this. He's asked, but will you support it after select committee? And he says, I couldn't be clearer. I don't see how I could be clearer, and then doesn't answer yes or no. Because he can't answer no, because then that would make a mockery of the undertaking that is given in the coalition agreement. How is he managing that? Is it, he gave a speech at Ratana yesterday in which he said, we will not mess with the Treaty of Waitangi. We are not changing things tum to tum. Audrey Young wrote quite an interesting piece in which he said he appeared to have written memos to his speechwriters saying, make this as dull as possible, which might be quite a good tactic. We don't want to attract more heat to this issue. He doesn't want to be the centre of attention here. It's a very long-winded question. How is he managing it? Is this just MMP politics and we have to get over it? Has Christopher Luxon made a rod for his own back in the coalition agreement?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a rod there, but, you know, whether he made it for himself or whether ACT, you know, insisted on it being there and then giving him a few whacks with it in exchange for confidence and supply. You know, that's the question. None of us were in the room for the coalition negotiations. What we do know is that spirits within New Zealand First and ACT sort of hardened as the process went on, and they demanded, you know, it's understood that they sort of, you know, presented a more united front to try and really kind of screw concessions out of National,
right.
You know, because in terms of the treaty referendum legislation, that was something that throughout the campaign, Luxon said, absolutely not, won't do it. Even through the negotiations where Luxon himself otherwise had very good message discipline in terms of not discussing what would be, you know, what was under talks, said that we won't have a treaty referendum. We're not going to have it. It would be divisive.
He's repeated that. It would be divisive.
And look, it in the end, there was
he was right.
Yeah, and look, in the end, there was a compromise, right, which was that they would support the legislation to the first reading and there was no commitment beyond that. Now, in a coalition agreement, that's generally code for we're not going to support this, but we'll let you have a public airing of it.
Aeration.
Yes, an aeration, that's right. Seymour has sort of taken that less as a kind of snub and more as a challenge, saying, well, look, if we can get it to select committee, we can have the debate that I want, the public debate on the principles and what they should be, you know, according to the ACT Party versus, you know, the numerous people who will presumably contribute, which will include, you know, groups from, you know, far on the other side who say the principles are just a sort of halfway reheated.
But Waititi doesn't want principles to be applied at all. Because
if you're a fan,
it's watering down the words of the treaty.
The late Moana Jackson, you know, Matiki Mai, you know, that contemplates something far in excess of what the treaty principles contemplate in terms of sort of equal power sharing and these sorts of things. So, you know, there will be, you know, that debate, and it'll get a lot of airtime for, you know, for a period of, what, maybe 4 to 6 weeks, say. Luxon did actually, again, went as far as saying, I think in response to a question by Takuta Ferris, the new Māori Party MP, at question time just before Christmas, he actually said the bill will go to select committee and it will go no further. Well, that's as far as it will go, or something like
that. Some of the phrasing's been a bit... open to interpretation about whether the commitment goes no further or whether it will go no further.
I think we know what he meant, but it was probably a bit of a slip.
I think
that was where he sort of got a little bit loose.
Yeah.
And just as we've also, you know, Tohunade has been tweeting that apparently Christopher Luxon, in one of his numerous meetings with King Tuheitia, assured him that ACT would vote the bill down at second reading.
National would vote the bill down at second reading.
Now, that's totally plausible, and I'm sure he probably did say that to Tuheitia. But of course there is this, you know, you do need this deference to what's in the coalition agreement in order to keep all three parties happy and on the same track, you know, still only what, fucking 2 months into the new government, right? But what we are seeing is a lot of needling and undermining, right? Particularly from the two smaller parties. So, you know, New Zealand First have got their own anti-treaty legislation and reviews and things promised, you know, in their coalition agreement.
Yes.
So they've come out much more openly. Shane Jones said, you know, we're not gonna support it past the first reading in terms of ACT's
but then
he walked it back.
Yeah.
Because he realized, yeah, he probably got the hard word from the chief. He got a call from the chief of staff saying,
but also,
hey, come on, look.
But also New Zealand First position, and I mean, you know, the espoused position by Shane Jones and Winston Peters is that the Waitangi Tribunal needs a good dressing down.
Yeah, yeah, but they've got their own review for that, right?
Right, but that's the treaty principles that underpin the operations of much of the tribunal, right?
It underpins some of the decision making by the tribunal.
I think that's what they've latched onto, is what I'm saying. This is a way that we can have a go at the tribunal.
That's part of it. But I mean, the other stuff that Jones is looking at, and he's talked about this for a long time in terms of the tribunal, are things like its jurisdiction. You know, does it have the jurisdiction to to look at the entire health sector and then start making policy recommendations about it, the so-called Kaupapa claims. And, you know, sometimes you do see the Waitangi Tribunal tying itself into incredible knots, getting a little outside its purview, because it's essentially a bunch of treaty lawyers and historians sitting as a panel. And, you know, over the water claims, they were getting into all sorts of trouble, sort of asking expert witnesses what a share was in a company and then trying to reinvent company law sort of from the ground up in their decisions. And they you know, the usefulness of the tribunal really starts to suffer once as they get further and further away from core business. But the major point here, though, is that I think in terms of the dynamics of the coalition partners is that I think New Zealand First are very happy to see that, you know, now the news stories that maybe ACT's bill is dead on arrival, it's not going to go anywhere, it's all just a bit of sound and fury signifying nothing, but New Zealand First's rolling back of the power of the Waitangi Tribunal, that's something that's still going somewhere, because there is that jockeying, right, between New Zealand First and ACT for a particular vote, which is the, you know, the so-called the anti-treaty or what, anti-modification.
One rule for all.
Yeah, that sort of vote. And in the middle, you've got poor old Luxon going like, I want to bring us all together. And, you know, and it's a really hard act for all of them to kind of coordinate together.
I think, you know, for Māori, the problem that Luxon has is that because of the coalition agreement, he can't definitively rule out supporting it past select committee. But until he definitively rules out supporting it past select committee, Māori are going to continue to agitate and be concerned and question what's going on there.
Yeah, because you can't have it both ways, can you? You can't say, oh, don't be silly. Don't be silly getting so exercised by this thing, you know, because we haven't given a commitment. All right, then, be clear. I couldn't be clearer that we have not given a commitment. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, no, we don't know what you're saying.
Foreheads are sort of leaning in, just sort of like, you know.
And because I think this government has created an environment where people expect the unexpected now because, you know, for example, rolling back our smoking legislation was absolutely not on the cards and not being discussed during the election campaign meaningfully, and then it popped up. So I think people are on higher alert than they might ordinarily be.
David Seymour.
And the other thing is that, yeah, and so all National are doing, you know, Lux, and this brings back to your point about Audrey writing about how sort of boring Luxon's speech was. National are trying to play a totally straight bat on this, especially during the sort of this danger period of, you know, the Hui, the Ratana and Waitangi. You know, no deviations from the norm, you know. In the past, you know, you see people, party leaders, prime ministers talking about spending Waitangi Day somewhere other than Waitangi, but Luxon's like, no, absolutely, orthodox thing. Last year he spent, I think he spent Waitangi at Orake with Ngāti Whātua, but this year it's like, no, Waitangi, just doing the normal things, not scaring the horses. And he's and what they've been doing, you know, and, you know, you might, if you were so inclined, you might feel a bit bad for the Prime Minister in this respect. You know, they've made a couple of announcements since becoming government, which, you know, are very close to what Luxon was talking about on the campaign trail in terms of empowering Māori on the front line. So there's a $50 million boost for Māori immunisation before Christmas, which is going to go directly to whānau ora providers and frontline iwi and Māori health providers. And that's totally in line with the, you know, the policies that National ran on. And they also, I think they, on the more sort of symbolic front, they sort of guaranteed that there wouldn't be any cutbacks to the extra 20, wasn't it, the extra 15 million over for each of 2 years for Te Matatini. So, you know, obviously the rhetorical kind of impact, and actually, you know, the actual policies of, in a lot of cases, from the coalition agreements really were like really just kind of smacking Māoridom in the face and going, you know, like, you know, the combined effect is, you know, there's a very hostile kind of, you know, new ground for conflict. But, you know, National are doing their best to just try and roll out their agenda and their policies and sort of
get through this wall of flames.
Some would say that, you know, the injustice of it is that Luxon and National, in the weekend at the Hui Amotu, Tama Pōtaka and Dan Bidwa are the ones that are having to front up and defend a policy that's not theirs.
No.
And the party who has instigated this debate is, you know, having long called for a debate on these issues is not fronting up at any of the hui where the debate or the discussion is happening.
You mean David Seymour? Just to be clear, I mean David.
Exactly, I do mean David Seymour. The other thing I just wanted to quickly touch on about Hui Amotu is one of the other really compelling things that happened at Hui Amotu is you guys and our listeners might recall that Ngāti Whātua Ōrākei and Waikato have had a very rough couple of years relationship-wise because of over-treaty issues and cross-claims in the Auckland region. At Hui Amotu, Ngāti Whātua came, a number of their rangatira were there. One of their key rangatira wahine was running one of the tents and facilitating one of the hui. So it was a really powerful message of unity that came from those two iwi as well who have been able to put aside their differences to come together and discuss these issues. So I think a lot of people were really impressed by that as well, and it shows how seriously they're taking what's going down.
We'll move on. I just wanted to mention there was one fantastic Luxonism in the interest of kind of being as straight and pushing things on. He said that he was happy with the dissent that appeared and he, you know, embraced the debate, all the irrational and stuff. And he said, and I quote, "That's part of the process of being part of the process," which I thought, summed up a lot.
I love that.
Let's talk about the deployment of 6 New Zealand NZDF personnel are being deployed to the Red Sea. It was announced on Monday afternoon after the first cabinet meeting of the year, and we had a slightly awkward lineup in the Beehive Theatreette of Christopher Luxon, Winston Peters, the Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, and Judith Collins, who's the Defence Minister. It was kind of apart from the very seriousness of the occasion, I sort of had a moment of thinking, who would have thought that you would have those three together on a stage?
The gang's
several years ago. It's kind of amazing to behold. But very serious matter. New Zealand has committed troops backing an American-led, American with sort of the Brits and mostly in support, in attacking Houthi bases in Yemen. The Houthis are a militant Shia group that kind of formed in the mid-90s, I think, and came to power seized large parts of Yemen following the Arab Spring when Saleh was deposed. And they now control large parts of the west of Yemen, and that includes great part of the border on the Red Sea, which, of course, is the Red Sea. At the top of the Red Sea is the Suez Canal, and that is a main shipping lane. And they have been attacking cargo ships. And there's been some raids and a bunch of missiles. And the Houthis, it's important to remember, have been part of a long-running civil war in Yemen. Some people regard it as a proxy war. The Houthis are backed by Iran, sponsored by Iran, and the recognized government, they're supported by the Saudis. And horrible, horrible, horrible civil war. I think there are, you know, like estimates of 150,000 people being killed during that war. So the Houthis have a sort of established a kind of version of government in their part of the country, and some people say that their stated defense of solidarity with Gaza is partly also because they want to firm up their support among the population in Yemen. Anyway. It's a very complicated situation, as so many of these conflicts in the Middle East are. Lots of kind of overlaying priorities and agendas. New Zealand getting involved there, interestingly, Luxon, Peters, and Collins all insisted that it was folly to try and conflate what was going on there with what has happened in Gaza, which is hard to reconcile with the very clear stated ambitions of the Houthis to that their acts are in support of Gaza. They actually attempted to fire missiles into Israel in the days after the appalling attacks of October 7 when Hamas went into Israel. But it is a very complicated situation. Annabelle, is New Zealand right to be getting involved? Is this an important point of principle? And is it plausible to suggest that it's not linked to that it's somehow separated out from the conflict that's playing out in Gaza?
Well, the Houthis weren't attacking ships, cargo ships, before October 7, and now they are. Also important to point out that, as far as I'm aware, no one has been killed by the Houthis in these attacks. Should New Zealand be getting involved? I don't believe so. I think the argument that it's about upholding international law is somewhat weakened by the fact that we know that there's all sorts of incredibly serious human rights breaches and probably war crimes being committed against the people of Gaza by Israel, the American-backed Israeli government. And we haven't made any strong announcements about that. We haven't condemned Israel. We haven't put in place trade embargo sanctions. Not that we don't have a huge amount of trade with Israel, but symbolically still important.
Well, New Zealand has not in fact called for an immediate ceasefire.
No, I think we've said a cessation of hostilities, but not called for a ceasefire. So I think it's a weak position that New Zealand's taken. I don't understand why we're getting involved. You know, we do business with other countries that have highly questionable human rights issues going on, which we choose to ignore, and we choose to ignore because we're reliant on their trade. This is a different situation. We don't have those sorts of ties, and I don't know why we would choose to get involved in this particular conflict against the Houthis.
It's an interesting one, Ben, because there are sort of two categories of support for these attacks. And we originally put our name to the statements which come out from the White House from time to time, and they have this sort of list of countries that are acting in support.
That's right, because we supported the original strikes.
We did, and then in early January.
So we were one of 10 countries that were involved, of the coalition.
Right, and the now there are sort of, that category to say we support is quite different to putting skin in the game, in effect. To, you know, it's only six people, but these things lead to other things. There are risks. No one would deny that there are risks involved, not just to the personnel involved, but to the repercussions. Conflicts in the Middle East have a tendency to compound.
There are flashpoint for extremism.
And
that presents risks even at the bottom of the
world. We should always be de-escalating and disarming and playing a peacekeeping role, not actively getting involved by sending personnel.
It's been stressed that these personnel will not be going into Yemen. I mean, at this point, as far as we're aware, there aren't troops in Yemen. But it's an interesting
one. But
they're
helping to bomb military.
Correct.
Things in Yemen, right?
Correct. So they're trying to. I mean, basically, at the bottom of the Red Sea, it's like 25 kilometers across. It's incredibly tight. So this is shipping lane. It's very vulnerable, and they're trying to take out the launch sites. It's worth remembering that over this long running civil war, a very well armed Saudi Arabia could not knock out the Houthis, who were being supported, in supply and in funds by Iran, of course. Anyway, Ben, do you think that this was a necessary thing for New Zealand to do in solidarity with our Western allies? I mean, I wonder whether just as a Labour haven't said they wouldn't support it. It's easier to do that in opposition. In Britain, the Labour opposition do support Britain's involvement.
But they've got people like resigning from the party and stuff, eh?
It's controversial.
Yeah,
and in
super
Britain, there's
controversial.
One of the complications is that there's strikes, and you can support strikes. This is now a campaign. A campaign can transmogrify, metastasize into a conflict becomes a war. I don't, you know.
I mean, you know, at a very basic level, New Zealand does have, you know, fundamental interests in secure and safe shipping mm-hmm. routes mm-hmm. around the world. We're a trading nation. I'm not quite sure what our direct exposure in the Suez Canal is, but we have an interest in that kind of order. We can't enforce that in Southeast Asia. Strategically, we do rely on the sort of presence of the United States. I think it's been well noted by all of the geopolitical experts, including me, that, you know, over the last six years, we have become more, we have had more of a dual foreign policy, where strategically we have been sort of getting closer and closer back to the United States, and running that kind of tightrope with how does that impact on our economic sort of intertwining with China.
And that certainly seems to be Winston Peters' priority.
Yeah, that's right. And look, I think that, you know, at a very basic level, when you become, you know, strategically aligned, quote unquote, with your partners, there is an expectation that you contribute. We're never expected to contribute, you know, on a per capita basis or an equal basis, certainly. But there is an expectation that, yeah, you get some skin in the game. Are our six men absolutely necessary for this effort? I'm not a military expert, but I suspect not. But I suspect it's that sort of
clearly. You
know, yeah, it's binding us in. Now, in a logical sense, is this related to stopping, you know, what could, you know, very arguably could be called a genocide in Gaza?
The ICJ is considering that question at this moment.
Yeah. I mean, logically, no.
South Africa.
The Houthis have not succeeded in de-escalating the conflict in Israel with their own activities in the Red Sea. And so I think it's just a logical mistake to sort of think that by taking action or supporting the United States, it's somehow, you know, keeping things going in Gaza.
I don't think the suggestion is that. I think if anything, it's the inverse, which is that the Houthis are quite interested in expanding the conflict into a region-wide conflict that's already spilled over into Lebanon and Syria. And so the fallacy is to suggest that what is going on in Yemen is somehow isolated from what's going on in Gaza, because it isn't. And so the risk of things spilling into a wider regional conflict, it is clearly linked to what's going on in Gaza.
Yeah, I think it's linked, but I don't think that it is. I don't think that it determines New Zealand's position on what's happening in Gaza. I think that New Zealand could certainly call for a ceasefire while participating in strikes against the Houthis, and those things aren't contradictory.
Mm. And to be fair to Luxon, he has said that he will respect the ICJ's. I think he said, I'm not going to remember his exact wording, but the ICJ will make a preliminary ruling anytime quite soon on whether or not Israel should be, whether or not there is a case for it being a genocide. And then they would urge Israel to stop. I mean, I think Netanyahu's already said, well, we won't be doing that. I mean, they also urged Putin to stop in Ukraine, which is but I think Christopher Luxon has said that international law is important and that should be respected.
The problem is that New Zealand, after 100 days of bombing, hasn't taken a clear position on Gaza, and yet we're prepared to stump up six of our people to go and fight the Houthis on behalf of the US.
Move on now back to domestic matters, but in fact one of the voices that we would have heard in this deployment of troops would have been Goris Gariman, who was spoke on lots of these issues for the Green Party, but has resigned from Parliament. And this was a really early on in the year, it emerged through reporting by a new kind of bolt-on subscriber part of Newstalk ZB, Newstalk ZB Plus, run by Philip Crump, former lawyer, used to use the Thomas Cramner pseudonym.
I think he still does. I think he's still got a Substack, yeah.
Anyway, it was reported that Goris Gariman faced allegations of shoplifting in an upmarket Auckland boutique Scotties, including a dress that might have costed $15,000, which is amazing.
No, I think it was
collectively $15,000.
Yeah, collectively.
Okay, right, okay.
And so I think their highest priced dress was $15,000.
And then
I was talking to somebody who said, "How do you shoplift a dress? How do you just like?" My experience with these things is like
of your shoplifting experience.
It's inversely proportional. You know, you're not paying for the material, right? Like once you get up to sort of $7,000 dresses, it's basically like, you know, you order one, it comes in an envelope. Like,
right.
So, you know, it's kind of basically just a magician trick, like, you know, the kind of scarf trick, but in reverse as you feed it into your pocket and like.
You've got some experience in buying expensive clothing and then disappearing. There was that whole episode.
The cardigan. Oh, the thing.
Did we? I don't know if we did end up including that in our lockdown pods. It was a time.
No, it was post-lockdown.
Was it?
Yeah.
I think it was lockdown
time.
No,
it wasn't.
Okay.
It was
post-lockdown.
It was
post-lockdown.
Anyway, then it turned out there was a second allegation and then there was a third allegation in Wellington. As we stand, Gurriman faces charges on those allegations of shoplifting. There was a weird kind of vacuum for a few days. It was very early in January. Gurriman was overseas. And then she returned and she issued a statement. The Green co-leaders, James Shearer and Marama Davidson, gave a press conference. And then... Of course, we had a whole lot of media coverage because one of the things that was cited in the statement were mental health issues that Gurriman faced and also some of the abuse that she's faced.
I don't think that was in the statement.
Was that not in the statement? That followed thereafter?
I think that was in the press.
That was James Shore
afterwards.
I mean, there was... And I don't think any reasonable person can deny the truth of that. You simply need to log on. It's not secret. And then there was a whole lot of further stuff that came into inboxes. Mm. Anyway, it's hard to know. You know, there's a lot of commentary on this, Annabelle. Can it not be that it can be appalling, some of the realities that Gurriman has faced?
Mm.
We should be sympathetic to mental health issues
and
it's inexcusable
yes.
to shoplift and a resignation matter, which it's been. I'd like to think I can hold all those thoughts in my head at the same time.
I can too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's incredibly disappointing. You know, Golra's is obviously a very impressive woman who took a really courageous stances on a number of issues, including the conflict in Gaza. It's incredibly disappointing that her shoplifting has impacted the credibility of the position she took on those issues and is being used to undermine those take, like what's happened in Gaza. I accept that her shoplifting is related to a mental health issue, just like some people indulge in alcohol, you know, develop an addiction to alcohol or whatever as a means of dealing with stress. So I understand that for a number of women, shoplifting is a way that stress manifests itself.
Exercising control over your environment, according to two pieces I read in The Guardian.
Mm. Stephen Franks actually did a really interesting tweet about this as well, about how among the legal fraternity, it's quite well known that women over the age of 40 can develop a shoplifting disorder.
Yeah, the Guardian wrote about this. It's a social phenomenon.
Is it self-sabotaging? Is that what it is? I mean, I don't want
to... I mean, they offer a few variety of things and some of it's about sort of taking control of your life. Mm. Some of it's about the dopamine hit, sort of, you know, to reduce stress. Some of it is just sort of inexplicable compulsive behaviour. And then they talk about how kleptomania might even be more widespread than we think because... In the same way as sort of, you know, it's hard to sometimes figure out the difference between drowning and suicide stats.
Nobody
ever thinks
stats.
To attribute kleptomania to poor people who shoplift.
Mm.
You know, they always think, oh, well, they're probably just stealing because they're poor, you know. But it could actually be a compulsive behaviour as well. Mm. So, yeah, a lot of really interesting stuff to dig into.
Yeah. So anyway,
for the armchair psychologist.
As Golra says, we expect a much higher standard of behaviour from our MPs. Mm. It's she did the right thing by resigning. I think it's really sad that her career has ended this way, because it was great to have the voice of, you know, a refugee represented in our House of Representatives. Mm. And I think although the Greens have been criticised for the way they've handled it, I think they did the best in a really difficult situation where, you know, the police aren't communicating with you because it's actually technically none of your business and all of that sort of stuff. I think people will move on pretty quickly from it. But, you know, it's going to haunt Goldra's for the rest of her life, and that's a shame.
Yeah, look, I think I think the criticism of the Greens and the leadership has been pretty unfounded. Very difficult position to be notified of this sort of between Christmas and New Year's. The MP is about to leave the country. In these positions, you know, it's not the same as an errant minister where the Prime Minister can just sack them from their warrant and then let nature take its course.
Yeah.
You actually don't, apart from invoking the extraordinarily complex and largely unsuccessful Walker jumping legislation, which is a sort of years-long process, if an MP is not ready to retire or to leave, you can't make them. And certainly, you know, yeah, if you're not operating on full information, it's not up to you to sort of go public with the allegations made by sort of retailers or whatever. You know, you are left in a difficult position. I think they just squared it away kind of as quickly as they could. Obviously, you know, by the end of it, at least Gutterman and the leadership were on the same page and, you know, did exactly what they needed to do. You know, look, in terms of its impact on her future, you know, these things don't have to be the end.
Defining,
right? The public aren't stupid, and they can distinguish between, you know, really morally reprehensible things that people do in office, which lead to the end of their careers, and things that, you know, simply just necessitate you having to go. Yeah. And so, you know, what actually is more important is what you do from there. Mm. And, you know, how how you kind of take steps, you know, becoming a bit of a public role model is often part of that, you know, I don't think it's all doom and gloom.
And it's worth just reiterating that Goldra's Gutterman issued a statement saying people should rightly expect the highest standards of behaviour from their elected representatives. Mm. Yep. I fell short. I'm sorry. It's not a behaviour I can explain because it's not rational anyway. And after I understand it, I'm not well. But with that in mind, I don't want to hide behind my mental health problems and I take full responsibility for my she's resigned. Yeah, I think that's just easy to forget when we talk about, you know, making excuses or all that sort of stuff.
I think her supporters in a lot of ways haven't done her any favours, in the same way as when Jacinda Ardern resigned, where Ardern resigned saying, look, I'm just done with the job really and I don't feel like I have too much more to offer. And then her biggest supporters suddenly made this a narrative about women being forced from office by trolls, which I think is, one, unhelpful, and two, not true in Ardern's
case. But can't we have those two conversations at the same time?
I don't think it was that they were saying
say the same conversation.
I don't think they were saying she was forced from office by trolls. Unrelenting abuse and threats of sexual, physical violence against her created, meant that she affected her mental health, which then caused her to engage in behaviours that, as she said, are not rational and ordinary and not okay for an MP to be doing. And that's what's led to her having to resign. Not that she got trolled out of Parliament per se.
I think it's good to respect the MP's words on that. It was interesting, you know, it was actually interesting when other politicians were asked about, you know, the kind of environment in Parliament. I think Luxon said it was a tough environment. there are a lot of tough workplace environments, also true, and that, you know, MPs, you know, that parties should be providing as much support as they can to MPs. MPs should be proactively looking for help and assistance, which is definitely true. You do have a responsibility to sort of, you know, look after yourself if you're in a public role to try and sort of get the help that you need. Then I think... Then they asked Mark Mitchell on the way about mental health in Parliament, and particularly in the Garraman case, and he said, you know, I think getting exercise and a good diet is really important for mental health, and he was basically, I think, describing a boot camp. It was, you know, a few laps around the obstacle course, that all kind of.
I didn't see any politicians, for what it's worth, attempting to, you know, leap on this and make capital law or any of that.
So no, which I think something is absolutely
to be, something to be
yeah.
said for that.
Yeah.
And the other thing that is really more important than any of this is that we are now seem set to have our second former Wellington mayor take up a seat in Parliament with Celia Wade Brown, the next on the green list. I don't know if that's been confirmed that she'll be going in. And I like to imagine, do you remember when Justin Lester was the mayor of Wellington and he was picked as the sort of one of the great shining, you know, future Labor's, of Labour. Yeah. He could be a future leader of the Labour Party. Anyway, that didn't work out. But now I'd like to see through his goggles the view of Celia Wade Brown joining Andy Foster on the benches of the New Zealand Parliament. What a club that is. And on that note, that's enough. Good to be back. Q Theatre, and whenever it is, Thursday the 15th of February. Thanks, everybody. Nice to see you guys. Kia ora.
Kia ora e te iwi. Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.